listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, in our weekly conversation with Professor Tony Montero, we further developed the idea of imperial retreat, with particular reference to an article published in the past week in Foreign Affairs magazine by Richard Haass, a former member of the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. It's entitled, How a World Order Ends and What Comes in Its Wake. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure as always.
The pleasure's mine, Don DeBar.
So let's start with a theme that you raised during the presidential campaign, at least. And this is entitled, the piece is entitled, How a World Order Ends, and subtitle is, And What Comes in Its Wake.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and if you recall, Don, we were called everything that could be called, that you could be called, as an apostate, as a revisionist, as a traitor. As
Trumper, you're a Trumper.
Yeah, a lunatic, but we see now with Richard Haass, and we have pointed to others who have some eminence, who have said pretty much what we have been saying. And now Richard Haass is not a small player in this. He's the head of the Council on Foreign Affairs, which is the most prestigious think tank in the United States on matters of foreign policy and foreign relationships. And in this essay in Foreign Affairs, which is online, it'll appear in the print, hard print copy in January. But what Richard Haass is saying is that the old order that came into existence 73 years ago is now ending.
Right.
And there is nothing to replace it with. And he queries, how do we manage the deterioration or the end of the old order?
Right.
And the problem is he has no answers about what will come next and whether or not, I think he kind of even says that the new order will not be a U.S. or Western dominated world order. The rise of Asia is too rapid, too profound, and certainly within the not too distant future, the three largest economies, national economies in the world, will be China, Japan, and India,
right.
All Asia. And the breakup of Europe that we see taking place, the chaos in the politics of Britain and Germany and now France, all of this suggests the end of an old order. The rise of Trump is not the rise of fascism, but the manifestation of a profound crisis and the urge of the mass of working and middle class people, of the poor, that we have to take care of the needs of the people in this nation and not be the overseer, the hegemon of a world order that enriches a few but impoverishes the vast 80% of the U.S. population. And they're saying the same in France. They're saying the same in Great Britain. Frankly, they're saying the same in Germany. They're saying the same in Italy,
right,
in
right.
Spain. Need we go further?
Right. It's bubbling everywhere. I mean, we've seen
everywhere. So Haas is absolutely right. The old world order is ending. It had almost a 80-year run. Now it's over. And it's a good thing. We've called it imperial retreat. We've called it empire dismantling. We've called it any number of things. And we've pointed to the fact that when it comes to war and peace, Trump is, in fact, the most pro-peace president we've had since John F. Kennedy. Now he's talking about significant cuts in the military budget, in the next fiscal budget. He's talking about everything that we have said he might do in his first term as president. And those who do not see it, in some instances, it is because they don't want to see it. They're locked into a kind of dogmatism of theory and politics. But then there are those who have a vested interest in obscuring this.
Wow, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, Haas points that out himself. For a little bit of context, he's an interesting messenger, in his own career. You know, you mentioned a 70 to 80 year run since, you know, the post-war order, in essence. But the Haas really comes on the scene, you know, in the setup to the Reagan administration and everything that follows since. He comes into his own then, he becomes an insider. And then he starts talking very clearly. He wrote a book, The Reluctant Sheriff, in the mid-90s, for example, where he was advocating that the U.S. play the role of international sheriff, which is an interesting thing because that had been doing that for quite some time. But he's saying that this should be official, public, you know, openly accepted policy. And he's talking about an empire that he said should be, he used the British Empire as a model. That he gave a lecture in 2000 saying that the U.S. could maintain informal control over the world when possible, but have direct control if necessary. And this is only 18 years ago. And now, at this point, and he started a year or two back saying, well, no, the world has changed. We screwed up. He refers to his own position on the Iraq War, for example. He was with Colin Powell when Powell was the head of the Department of State, and that there were blown opportunities and just changing conditions, rising multipolarity, where that's no longer the case. And now he's on this thing that you're talking about, which you were talking about several years back.
Right, right. In fact, the term that you just used, going from the unipolar, i.e. the Reagan's vision,
right,
of the indispensable nation, of course, further consolidated and concretized in the Bush and Obama administrations.
Right.
Now we're looking at, really, the multipolar world. And that is what Trump has accepted. And he is literally an effective advocate from the presidency of a multipolar world. This is a less war-like world. Once you defuse or defang the U.S. military's capacity to wage any number of wars anywhere in the world, we have entered a more peaceful world. I don't know how you get around that.
Yeah. You know, Haas has got some interesting contradictions even now.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, he looks critically at the 2003 invasion of Iraq, including his own role in that.
Right.
He also looks critically at the Libyan war. He said he was against it, as a matter of fact. And then he turns around and says, but Obama screwed up because they should have intervened in Syria.
And
you know, more directly. So, you know, the kind of lessons that he's learned and, you know, that I think he wants to bring to the table would have people do exactly the same thing. In other words, would be a continuity of policy, you know, dressed up as a reversal of policy.
Well, I don't know that that is the case with him. See, I think, like all of the neoliberal and neocon elites, they're not going willingly into the new world.
Right.
They do it reluctantly. They do it protesting all the way. But as a so-called realist in foreign policy, kind of in the Kissinger mold, he has to acknowledge and ideologically prepare the next generation of elites for the world that they will inherit. And that is not a world of U.S. domination or U.S. hegemony. And that's what I think he's saying. And he's looking at, he's saying, I support the war, I support it. No, what he's saying is he's against Russia's intervention in Syria to protect the Assad government. And he felt that there were some diplomatic and other economic pressures and sanctions that we could have put on Russia to change their behavior. But I think in this overall scheme, it is an end to the whole triumphalism of the post-Cold War, so-called post-Cold War, post-collapse of the Soviet Union moment. That is gone. In a larger sense, it is a pullback from the 73-year run, which includes the Cold War and the so-called post-Cold War moment. And he has to acknowledge that something fundamentally different is on the horizon. What that will be, he doesn't know. How China will behave, how Russia will behave, what will be, for example, the situation in Central Asia. For example, he doesn't mention it, as I recall, but Iran and Iraq, where the Iraqi government is now more pro-Iran than it is pro-U.S., and so on. And then you add to that the consolidation of the victory of the Assad government over ISIS and the Islamic jihadists who are all backed by the United States and other Western governments. I think we're looking at a, and he is acknowledging it, this huge shift. And as Gareth Porter has pointed out, at least tepidly, could Trump represent the end of the American empire? And to that question, I say probably so, if he can survive politically and even physically.
Yeah, I mean, he's referring to that here under managing the deterioration, basically.
Yes.
This is, again, we're talking about an article in Foreign Affairs at foreignaffairs.com, Richard Haass, How a World Order Ends. The subheading, Managing the Deterioration, goes right to that, to that stuff right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of instructive. And I think, for example, the peace movement, to the extent that it exists in the United States, has to be informed by such thinking. You know, we don't have a real peace movement here in the United States. Right. We have advocates of certain aggressive policies of the United States. If we'd had a peace movement, we could have long ago stopped or stayed the hand of American imperialism and its role in Syria. We couldn't do it. We could do nothing about Libya and that aggression, and so on. And then on the Korean Peninsula, the peace movement says very little about the evolution of peace and demilitarization and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They like to focus upon Palestine, and often in the wrong way, and make that the center of all of the world's movement towards liberation, justice, and peace. That's a huge mistake.
Right.
So that's the way I would look at it. We need a peace movement. It has to be ideologically clear. It cannot be the same in form or content to the anti-Vietnam War movement. It's a different kind of thing, especially when they're not hundreds of thousands of young men being drafted into a war that they don't want to go to. That's a whole different thing from what we're looking at today. And I think that we have to reorient the peace movement, and we have to reorient the left if there is to be a serious left in the foreseeable future in the United States.
You know, there's some interesting, things being posited by, every time I see these people come back. You know, you think after Iraq, most of them would stay, like, out of the way, hiding someplace, say, oh my God, are they going to have a tribunal next week or whatever? But they don't. They knock down, I guess they go home in woodshed, drink a few six packs of beer or something, and then they come back out with a new line of nonsense that says, you know, sounds exactly like the old. The major alternatives to a modernized world order supported by the United States appear unlikely, unappealing, or both. Mm-hmm. A Chinese-led order, for example, would be an illiberal one, characterized by authoritarian domestic political systems and statist economies that place a premium on maintaining domestic stability.
Mm-hmm.
Come on now. Really?
Yeah.
That's all. That's the only possibility with a billion and a half to 2 billion people and a hybrid system that's being constructed as we speak, that just that one outcome must be it.
Well, I think what he's doing there is admitting that the United States has lost or is losing the ideological struggle on a world scale, that Western values are no longer appealing to the majority of people in the world. And in fact, so-called Western democracy is not a way that countries that have up to 1.5 billion people in them is not the way you govern effectively such nations. Certainly, I often refer back to Africa and these 54 different countries. Africa cannot govern itself in this way.
Right.
It's too costly, it's too ineffective,
right.
And it predisposes the entire continent to neocolonialism and being picked
right.
off by various Western nations, if not multinational corporations.
Yep.
There has to be a continent-wide governance system that is not based upon the liberal model of every 4 years elections or every 2 years and this constant cycle of corrupt political parties running nations or regions for the sake of the super rich and multinational corporations.
Yep.
So as Asia is finding out, and it's an important thing, these large nations, which are really civilizations, have to find ways of governance which effectively delivers for the masses of people in their civilizations or societies, however you want to put it. China, with 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion people, cannot be governed like England, an island,
right.
Whose wealth was based upon the colonization and,
theft,
and enslavement
right.
of hundreds of millions of people around the world.
Right.
China's just not going to be run that way. So those values, even if certain elites wish to embrace them, cannot be practically applied to these large nations or these large continental regions of the world. Just can't work.
Yeah. You know, and if you look at the United States, for example, coming out of its own colonial period, I mean, compared to Africa, you had, I don't know, 13, 15 colonies, a bunch of, you know, large territories that weren't even incorporated into the system, but it took the unification of those colonies into one nation state with arguably immense power for all their checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the supreme power was in the federal government. And you can see how over the last two centuries, all of the attacks on that power have taken place at the state level, you know, atomized like Africa is now. You look at things like you know, the various tax abatements, public funding of private business, all the different things, the abuses of the system that take place with everybody's race to the bottom, that's mm-hmm. enabled by the fact that there's 50 states. You can
yeah.
take your factory out of New York State and take it to Tennessee or Texas or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can pay people less. You don't have to give them the right to do this or that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Africa has that, you know, only on steroids, that condition.
Mm-hmm. And that's right. So, that's right. And so, you know, the tide of history is moving towards socialism.
Yes.
You know, and it's not because evil conspirators somewhere in the world are brainwashing people in cyberspace to hate capitalism.
Right.
It's because capitalism has run its course historically.
Right.
And the world's people cannot lift themselves out of poverty and hunger without moving to socialism.
Right.
India, for example, has no choice. China has no choice.
Right.
They have to move towards socialism. Now, a lot of people say, well, what is socialism? Well, it will take different forms. But the transition is clear. The historical transition is clear. The West is going into retreat, is in decline, which means that the major centers of world capitalism are in decline. Such things as the China-Africa discussion and practical connections and alliances on economic, political, and other matters. I mean, yeah, it's not perfect. You know, there are a lot of cultural differences, racial issues, and so on and so forth. But the alliance between Africa and China is preferable to an alliance between Africa and the United States or Africa and the West. Yep. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that's what we have to accept. And certainly, I would think, and this is kind of looking at things, the logical movement of history, that that the relationship between China and Africa will speed up the processes towards socialism in China and away from mere state capitalism. I think it's very important. Now, the other thing, by the way, which didn't get a lot of press coverage, is the two supersonic, potentially nuclear-armed jets from Russia arriving in Venezuela.
Right.
And Putin agreeing to make new loans in the billions of dollars to Venezuela. Right. Venezuela is not alone in the face of U.S. sanctions, right. You know? And this is hugely important. But one last thing, if you don't mind, Don. We kind of hit on this the last time, and that is Saudi Arabia. And this whole thing that the United States, which began the war in Yemen,
right,
under the Obama administration, and which armed Saudi Arabia to fight against the popular uprising against a illegitimate government. Now, the Senate of the United States is preparing to sanction Saudi Arabia as punishment, allegedly, for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and the outrage and the crocodile tears of U.S. senators over hunger and desperation in Yemen. By the way, there were no tears shed over the even more desperate conditions of the Syrian people over these last 9 years or so.
Right.
But that aside, but the point I think I'd like to make is that there's more to this than meets the eye. And it is that the current head of government in Saudi Arabia violated what appeared to be an agreement between Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian elites, and U.S. bankers who were interested and prepared to privatize Aramco, the Saudi oil company, which is the source of state wealth and right. of the welfare system right. in that country.
That's right.
That would have been an initial stock offering of multi-trillions of dollars. It would have meant that Western banks and corporations would own Saudi Arabia. Along with that, they were proposing severe austerity upon the Saudi people.
Yeah, which of course, as we know, would mean the end of the Saudi state, because
that's right.
It's
absolutely.
Only the spreading around of all of that money among the population that
absolutely
keeps that state in place with the craziness that it does. There's no real base other than bribing the population, basically.
That's right. And the last thing is Saudi Arabia moving closer to China, and the trade in oil between China and Saudi Arabia no longer in what they call the petrodollar, but in the petro yuan.
Yeah, we're seeing that kind of a dynamic happening in a number of places, and it's not an avalanche yet, and it's actually still kind of marginal in terms of the actual volumes, but they're significant numbers. They're real numbers. Yes. We're talking billions of dollars, and
it's a trend.
Grow. It's a trend. That's exactly
right. Of nations no longer relying upon the dollar as the reserve currency. In fact, most of the trade between China and Russia is either in rubles or yuan. And certainly this thing between Saudi Arabia and China is hugely significant, in my opinion. And that means that even a country like India might conceivably trade for Saudi oil in petro rupees.
Well, let's look around the landscape. You've got Russia, the Saudis, the Iranians, and Venezuela all having an interest in trading outside of the dollar regime. Those are the supply side. That's a pretty huge chunk of the supply side. Mm-hmm. And then on the consumption side, let's just start and finish with China, who's going to be, that's about a third of humanity. So it's a pretty good size of the market.
Definitely.
Yep.
And with China, you're talking about the largest economy in the world.
That's it. So, and certainly going forward, the largest consumer economy, which means the largest consumption of all of those things. All right, we got to stop here, Tony. Thanks a lot, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Spymania returns. The U.S. weaponizes its laws against adversaries. Also, is the Western world in crisis? And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Cross-talking some real news. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deeslin. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Since you wrote a book about the topic, I will go to you first. We all read the recent article by Pat Buchanan here, What Lies Behind the Malaise of the West. I thought it was a really fascinating article because he really kind of hit the nail on the head. It's really about a crisis of confidence in many ways. What was your take?
Well, we touched on this topic in previous segments. I think it all goes back to the system we put together after the Cold War. It's been a very liberal format for globalization. And already in the 1990s, it was realized that it wouldn't work for everyone. Indeed, it was a polarization between the elites and the people. I think in the European Union, we were able to cover some of these problems through the 2000s by simply ignoring referendums or making them vote again.
But you keep expanding.
Yeah, but then something has now happened over the last 2-3 years in which first we had the Brexit, then the election of Trump. There's been some attempts to walk that back as well. So Brexit's not really going to mean Brexit. And, the effort to essentially...
Trump is not really the president.
Yeah, not really the president, but... we'll see the same problem now in Europe. You can only hold it back for so long before it comes out in different forms. So the only two powers left to hold Europe together has been France and Germany. But now, as we see, Macron and Merkel is not gone very well. Merkel is now accepted she has to step down, but only to be replaced with Merkel II, essentially.
It's interesting, Merkel, because it seems to me that they've relied more upon ideology than on leadership. Okay, because the ideology is a substitution for leadership.
Well, I think that's an important part of the EU project specifically. I mean, this is backlash. This is a neoliberal, pro-globalization, pro-globalist, if you want to use that, elite who have forced both economic and social radical reforms on the peoples of Europe and also the United States and Canada over the heads of the people, using, you know, these repeat referendums and repeat votes in the EU.
Until
and
people
in the
get
US,
it right.
The U.S. And Canada using the distraction of identity politics. And this is done with a triangulated center-right, center-left parties. And we're finally seeing the backlash. And it's coming from the far right and the far left, as we've talked about repeatedly on this show. And now we've seen outbreaks of it in the United States with the election of Trump, in Germany with the, you know, the Grand Dame Chancellor Merkel having to stand down, in the German elite not knowing what comes after Merkel, and her whole political party is being crushed in the polls right now because of her mass immigration that she imported into the country. France rocked by protests against the
and then
the
we can go, look at the melees.
Brexit,
and then we have melees in Italy, Poland, Hungary,
Romania.
But you know, Dima, it's interesting. This whole ideology is predicated on destroying nations.
Absolutely. Well, and Pat Buchanan writes about it. He writes that loyalty to family, tribe, neighborhood, culture, and country appear paramount, rising above intellectual and political alignments. Well, the problem is, which intellectual alignments? What is being offered the people? You know, we have basically the same ultra-liberal narrative, both mostly in the United States, in the mainstream, and in Europe. And you know what happened in France? You know, the problem is that the ultra-liberal state, according to its ideology, it's not doing anything in industry. It allows big companies to do it. It's not doing anything in science. What it is doing is setting the rules of the game. And you have so many bureaucrats, and they have to be busy every day. So they invent, for example, yellow vests. You know, for some reason, all the people need to wear yellow vests in their cars. And then what's the response from the people? Ah, you wanted to see us? You will see us. But not only in the cars, in the streets. So it's a backlash against stupid rules, against the state, which is not doing anything except setting rules.
Is there any learning curve here? I mean, it seems to me the elites here maintain their ideology, because their ideology is a new catechism, and they can't adjust it in light of what's happening on the ground to normal people.
Well, I think the EU is extraordinarily incapable of doing anything about it, because the whole institution is built up on the idea that nationalism is inherently a bad thing and we need to elevate above it. However, with this, I guess, contempt for nationalism, and you know, often referred to as tribalism, it is strange because it's often assumed to be only a negative thing. But keep in mind that the nation state has been the strongest vehicle to promote human freedoms. And tribalism, it's not inherently a bad thing. I mean, if you care more about your kid than a random kid, that's a good thing. Like social fabric, it's at the local level, at the regional level. The fact that the idea that you would have the same affinity towards your neighbors, people are like you, as on some other side of the world, is not how the human nature works. It would be great if we were this global village. But
the tribe that counts most are these elitists with their ideology. That's the tribe that counts.
See, it's also a matter of political representation, because we have this transnational, ultra wealthy, ultra privileged economic and political elite that associate with and get along with and have far more in common with their
people.
Cosmopolitan peers around the world than they do with their own people in their own countries.
Well, I wanted to make a correction
creates
a
backlash.
On Glenn, you know, in Charles Dickens' novel, The Bleak House, you have a character who cares about kids in Africa, kids in Asia, kids in Latin America, and she doesn't care about her own kids who are hungry in that same house. So the idea is not that you don't care about others or about other nations. The idea of nation state is, If you can't care about your own country, about your own kids, you won't be able to properly care about the others. And this is the right message, I think.
Last word on this.
Yeah, I'll just say that this is what essentially is the problem in Brexit now, because if you look at the people who wanted to remain, they're all essentially they're aligning themselves more with the EU elites. So look at the speech of Blair, for example. He's not saying, let's respect democracy. This is a pride of the English. Instead, he's saying, listen, you're, you have to help us to get out of this vote. And this is what that's making a lot of people upset. So even if they're able to overturn it, imagine how
we saw how the bureaucrats helped Theresa May when she went purse in hand here. I want to change the spy mania here. Dima Maria Putina, did she get justice in the United States? Go.
Well, I mean, the whole idea that basically you can plead guilty and get a reduced sentence for a crime that you didn't commit is just awful. I mean, it goes against the Constitution of the United States, the Fifth Amendment. No one should be forced to testify against oneself. But what happened with Putin is that they offered her this deal, you know.
After being in solitary confinement for violating the Foreign Agents Act,
for posting her photos with lawyer rank Republican or NRA officials on Facebook. And they called her a spy for that. You know, spies do not post their pictures on Facebook. But I'm reading from The Guardian, you know, someone named David Smith writes in the headline, Russian spy Maria Butina, you know, pleads guilty in the U.S. And it's amazing that first they had this charge that she was, she was getting ahead, trading sex for getting ahead in her influence operations.
There's no evidence of that whatsoever.
They dropped it. But please note, where did all the Western feminism go when they have a woman whom they suspect of acting against them? It's exactly, you know, like Bolsheviks. Bolsheviks talked about proletariat, but if proletarians turned against them, the Bolsheviks were hardest on them. The same story is here. Here is a woman whom they suspect of not being disloyal, and they crush her.
Her only crime is that she's Russian here. Glenn, if what I find more outrageous, not only was she not given justice, is that how many thousands and thousands of people in Washington, D.C., lobby for foreign governments that are not registered with the government, and they get away with it.
Are they Russian?
You took my punchline, Mark.
Well, first, in terms of defining the spy, you have to first go and acquire information and hand it over to your...
Which they did not.
Your intelligence services. She wasn't actually acquiring illegal information, and she wasn't actually handing it off to any or having this contact with any security officer. So again, the spy definition, it fails on both ends of what a spy is supposed to do.
And spies would be exchanged, would not be.
What seems to have happened that they wanted her to sing, and she ended up composing.
Yeah, this is. As much a failure as it of the justice, it is even more a failure of the media. Constantly this refrain, Russian spy, Russian spy. She is not accused of espionage. She was not found guilty of espionage. They have not accused her of having any contacts with Russian intelligence. She hasn't acquired any information. What she is accused of with this Foreign Agent Register Act is being an unregistered lobbyist. She supported gun rights. She supported gun rights in Russia. She was actually censored online in Live Journal. Her posts were blocked by the Russian government, which is not a fan of the American conception of rights for guns or whatever it is. If anything... You know, she has her and this patron of hers, a banker, they support gun rights in both countries. They lobbied with the NRA. They also lobbied in
all
the EU.
All in public.
All in public. And she was as much a vehicle of trying to force the influence of American gun culture on Russia even more than the other way around.
But now you have... a few years ago, she would never have been arrested. This has to be put in the context of the election of Trump, because they've been for so long now trying to come with the smoking gun that Trump is this Russian agent. And now you finally have this Russian coming along.
She asked him a question at a press conference.
Hold those thoughts, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Glenn, let's go back to the weaponization of the law. Butina is not the only story in the news where the U.S. Weaponized the law. What's the second one?
Well, the second would be what has happened with the executive from Huawei from China. As she was also arrested in Canada and is now waiting extradition to the United States. And again, this is also, you can argue that this is also weaponizing the law to a similar extent as what was done against Maria Butina, to the extent that in the past, she would have never been arrested. You don't really
arrest
CEOs. Well,
they don't usually arrest individuals for the alleged crimes of their companies.
Only personal crimes.
But right, embezzlement.
Embezzlement. Yeah. But if your company has done, they argue that they've broken some laws, which is controversial on its own, you would go after companies starting to arrest the executives. This is something new, though.
The charge is absurd, and it's obviously political. It's a kidnap for ransom. She's accused of providing misleading information in a presentation to HSBC US UK Bank that facilitated a subsidiary company's no longer connected with Huize wealth transfer, money transfers over the head of unilateral, illegal U.S. sanctions, which were all erased by a U.N. Security Council resolution, which the U.S. also signed up to. And this is being presented. No, it's clear that this was planned months in advance. We know this. It was worked out with the Canadian Prime Minister. Any protestations of innocence, oh, we had to do it because of the extradition request. No, it was planned. They were looking at other ways to get her. They were looking specifically at other things, tech transfer and other things. This is a shot across the bow at China, at Chinese companies, and they picked one person that they could reach out and grab. And Trump could not have made it more obvious when he tweeted out that this is political by saying, oh, we could arrange her release as part of leverage with a trade deal. So much for U.S. Canadian judicial independence.
During the communist era, that was called telephone justice, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Well, but I think the most alarming thing is when ultra-liberals of all the people start having questions because it just goes over the board. Jeffrey Sachs, of all the people, analyzed the arrest of this Chinese woman, and he wrote in his article, The War on Huawei, in 2011, J.P. Morgan Chase paid $88 million in 2011 for violating U.S. sanctions against Cuba. Yet, Jamie Dimon wasn't grabbed off a plane and whisked into custody. End of quote.
But two Canadians, at least as we speak, were arrested by the Chinese.
Good.
Yeah, I mentioned that.
Good. China stands up and defends their national interests. Unfortunately, we don't see the Russian government doing the same over the case of Maria Butina. But kudos to China.
With Butina, there is another ultra-liberal, Leonid Bershitsky, on Bloomberg.
Okay, good.
Who notices, the final aim of all this separation.
Please, before, explain the political persuasions of the author.
Well, he is the most ultra-liberal of all the Russian ultra-liberal authors who went to Europe in the 2000s. In 1999, he refused to put the story on the apartment bombings in which hundreds of people died. You know, the Chechen terrorists then exploded several apartment buildings in Moscow. And he refused to put it on the front page because it's just some Soviet people dead, you know. So this kind of person is concerned about Maria Butina's
case. And he writes for Bloomberg. Okay.
And he writes for Bloomberg. And he writes that it seems to be that the case is that they want to let it be known after what the U.S. intelligence community considers massive interference in the presidential election, no unofficial back channels to Russia will be tolerated. End of quote. Well, this is really dangerous because unofficial back channels saved us from several real threats of nuclear war.
Including the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Including the Cuban
John
Missile
Kennedy
Crisis.
Required on a backhand channel averted the Cuban Missile
and
Crisis.
And during the 1967 war, you know, when the Israeli troops were getting close to Kunaitre in Syria, it was the back channel that saved the situation. You know, the Soviet Union was ready to react.
It's interesting.
And they
want
to make it sure that it doesn't exist.
It seems that the Trump administration, it's a shot over everyone's bow simultaneously. This is a very interesting, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. I mean, the United States wants to be America first. I understand that, but that means at the expense of everyone else. That is something a little bit different than what we've had before.
Yeah, but we are entering very
choppy waters.
Interesting times. I mean, if you look at the broad spectrum, what has really happened over the last few centuries has been that the West was really put in the driver's seat after the first industrial revolution in the mid-18th century. And since then, you had the second with combustion engine, the third with the computer chip and superconductors. So essentially, the West has always been in the driver's seat.
Yeah, now, don't forget the firearm.
Yeah, but now something different is happening. We have this new industrial revolution with artificial intelligence, robotics, automation,
and that's not only in the West.
Not only in the West, but the Chinese are actually set to have leadership in all of this. So suddenly after the first industrial revolution, which 100 years later on killed off China in the Opium Wars, now essentially they're coming back into the driver's seat. So this is a huge shift in history. And also for the first time in almost 500 years, the West is losing its primacy. So all of this is happening at once. And as we discussed last week, Huawei is one of the companies leading this technological...
But if we just take what Glenn had said there... The U.S. in its behavior is accelerating.
Yes.
This.
Yeah. Well,
alleviating. It's accelerating.
You know, the process is somewhat irreversible, and with this global neoliberal capitalist architecture that they assemble, that you know globalization runs on, they created it. They don't have a really way of stopping it. They're desperate. They're trying everything they can, and this extraterritorial extension of U.S. laws which aren't recognized anywhere else, like these unilateral sanctions, not illegal in Canada, but Canada acting as a pliant puppet state. Trudeau went ahead. Yeah, all he had to do, right, if he really wanted to avert it, was make a call to China and say, hey, don't drop by my country in a maritime, because I don't really want an international incident. And now he's bitten off more than he's chew, because China is by many measures now the world's largest economy, and which Canada is extremely dependent on, as most countries are becoming.
And
more
as we speak about this trade deal that Trump wants to make with the Chinese, the trade deficit only gets larger. It's not alleviating. It's getting larger.
This is after Trump browbeat Trudeau with tariffs and a new NAFTA.
I want to shift gears to something very important. Dima, what's going on with the Orthodox Church in Ukraine?
Well, the so-called convention of the new Ukrainian Orthodox Church took place in Kiev. It was presided for some reason by President Poroshenko. Talk to me about separation of church and state.
A political figure.
Yes, a political figure. The official, the real Ukrainian Orthodox Church, please don't listen to Western media when they call it Russian Orthodox Church. It's the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, autonomous from Russia financially. You know, they appoint their own bishops. Their metropolitan sits on the Council of Russian Orthodox Church. No Russian metropolitans are sitting in their synod. So this official Ukrainian Orthodox Church protested this convention. They didn't attend. Out of 30 bishops, only two were forced to attend, even though there were searches by the Ukrainian security agency. You know, there was several people were arrested. Still, they didn't go to this convention. They said it was not a canonical, but a political event. And what's the reaction in the Western media? I'm quoting France 24. You know, how did they report about it this morning? They said that Ukraine is finally coming out of Russia's religious influence, although some Ukrainians are still loyal to the Russian Church.
Mark.
Yeah. So I've got a quote that sums up the import of this, you know, and what is actually happening behind the scenes here. This patriarch of this separatist splinter Ukrainian church, Filaret, at least up until, the last few hours when he was replaced, he had an award ceremony this week where he gave an award specifically the Order of St. Andrew to Jack Devine. Who is Jack Devine? Jack Devine is the former associate director of the CIA. And in giving him the award, this Ukrainian patriarch, quote unquote, said, "Thank you for our independence. Thank you for the creation of our unified autocephalous Ukrainian Orthodox Church." Now, he's previously also given an award to John McCain over the putsch and his support that provided them there. So I think that pretty much sums up what is actually going on.
How is the laity reacting to all of this?
Well, I mean, people are dismayed, but they're also terrified because you have all over the Facebook, you have photos of these Ukrainian priests. There was even a flash mob, priests and their supporters put the inscription, "I am ready for a search by Ukrainian security service." and talking about the orders, just a few months ago, there was a similarly hilarious event. Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, gave the order of Prince Yaroslav the Wise to General Breedlove. Of all the people
of NATO,
for supporting Ukrainian independence. The problem is that Yaroslav Divine started as the Prince of Novgorod, which is in Russia. So if Yaroslav Divine was told, resurrecting from his grave 1,000 years later, that he is a symbol of Ukrainian independence and that his order was given to an American general.
But what's also, Glenn, so with the last 40 seconds here, what's going on here is also an asset grab. I mean, churches are being seized and... and property being taken.
Monasteries.
Monasteries.
Yeah. Well, I think it's to make the split more permanent because we in Ukraine, the Americans also supported the Orange Revolution back in 2004. And again, after they got stuck with Yushchenko, they realized it was horrible and they decided to go back to this idea that they should harmonize relations between the West and Russia. Now, Poroshenko just happens that the vast majority of Ukrainians now believe, more than 70% believe, that the country is going in the wrong direction. Yeah. So there is the assumption that they could change their mind again and realize the mistake is done.
All this engineering. They keep trying to engineer this nation. Yeah. We still have a nationalism without a nation. We've run out of time here, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Wars.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.